I'm Sean Corcoran. Welcome to The Point on WCAI. Our primary debates continue this morning, and let me welcome the Democratic candidates running for the Cape and Islands State Senate seat being vacated by Dan Wolfe. The Senate district covers 11 of the Cape's 15 towns, from Barnstable to Provincetown, as well as both islands. And Julian Sear is here. He's the Democratic candidate running, and his opponent, Sheila Lyons, is in traffic. Oh, I think she might be running in the door right now. Here's Sheila. So welcome, Julian, and welcome, Sheila, as you sit down.
Good morning.
Good morning. Before we begin, let me tell you about our format. You'll each have up to a minute to answer a question, and we'll rotate as to whom answers first. 30 seconds for rebuttals, if needed, and up to 2 minutes for closing comments. And we invite listeners to call in with questions. The number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. And you can also email us, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And just to remind listeners to ask a question that is directed at both candidates. And we we're going to flip a coin. We didn't have time to flip a coin to see who would go first. So if it's okay with you, Sheila, we could have the first question go to Julian so you can settle in a little bit.
That's great.
For listeners who may not be familiar with your backgrounds, tell us a little bit about yourselves and why you feel you'd make a good state senator.
Good morning, Sean. Thank you for having us. It's great to be back in Woods Hole. So my name's Julian Sear. I was born and raised and lived most of my life in Truro. Grew up in and of my family's small business. My family owned a restaurant in Truro for 28 years. Grew up in that business. And I've really spent my whole career and life in public service. Y'all don't need to hear from me that things are changing here on Cape Cod. We've become profoundly unaffordable. We have an opiate epidemic that's impacting our communities at four times the rate of others in the state. Our fragile environment. Life's never been easy here, but I think that we really need to embrace that change, steward that change. That's why I'm running for state senate. I'm someone who's taken on tough issues and have a record of accomplishment at the state level, working with the legislature, working with various state agencies, whether it's standing up to Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, leading the state's response to a pathogen that threatened to shut down oyster harvest, work in social justice, understanding a small business. And so that's why I'm running and running to be that progressive voice to carry on Dan Wolfe's work.
Thank you, Julian Sear and Sheila Lyons.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. I am Sheila Lyons. I am running because I am a social worker. I was born working class and baptized a devout Democrat, I'd like to say. And those values of being a Democrat, and which led me into being a social worker. And it's really the social work part of me that steps up when I see a problem, something that we can fix. I want to be able to see what I can do about that. So I saw that when I came here to live permanently, you start to see that there is an environmental problem when everybody leaves in the summertime, that there is an environmental problem and that there is a human need. There is a human poverty here in the wintertime. That led me to run for office for the Assembly of Delegates. I spent 2 years there. I saw the potential of the county government, and I ran for county commissioner. And for the last 8 years, I have been working on a lot of the issues that Julian just mentioned, and I am proud of my accomplishments in those 8 years.
Let's talk about the opioid crisis. Cape Cod had the state's highest rate of opioid deaths per capita in 2015. Are we doing enough to combat this epidemic? And Sheila, you can start.
We're not doing enough to combat that effort, although we have done a tremendous amount. When the governor stated that this was an epidemic, Governor Patrick, I did form a task force. I brought together the courts, the law enforcement, hospitals, agencies such as Gosnold and Duffy that work with people with addiction and homelessness, and various other therapists, 15 town membership. It's about 45 people around a table. We did put together a public health assessment our first year that gave us the ability to garner $500,000 more. The next year we put in together a plan which mirrors the governor's plan. It came out about 3 days before. Only we include alcohol addiction in our plan because alcohol addiction is also dominant on Cape Cod. I believe that what we did not do, what has not been done, is there is Over $1.5 million are lost every year on Cape Cod due to addiction through hospitals, and only 1% is put into prevention, and that is where we're lacking, prevention and treatment.
Julian's here.
So, Sean, I also want to mention that Martha's Vineyard, Dukes County, is not far behind Barnesville County in opiate overdose deaths. So addiction is nothing new in our communities, but I think with the, you know, we're experiencing a pernicious epidemic. We're losing a generation, and I'm not confident. As someone who's worked in public health, worked for the Department of Public Health for over 5.5 years, I'm not confident we're getting there yet. I think here on the Cape and the Islands, we need to start with treatment. We need to triage the situation. We've had no new beds on Cape Cod in a decade. There are no treatment beds on Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket. I was just talking to folks over there on island about that challenge yesterday. Prevention. We talk all about prevention, but $110 million is spent in Barnesville County on the opiate epidemic, and less than 2% of that goes to actually prevention. We need a dedicated funding stream for prevention. We have to help police intervene. They need more support and services there. You know, and finally, we need to fund our trial court for nonviolent offenders. The Barnesville County Trial Court currently is funded through in-kind donations and contributions. I mean, this is something that we've got to get a handle on. So got a lot more work to do here.
And let's stick with do you have a response?
No, I just want to say that I do think that there's been a lot of progress made on Cape Cod and the islands. We have gone over to the islands. We have shared our best practices. I have met before the commissioners of Dukes County. There has been a concerted effort across the Cape through the county's efforts to build coalitions, to help families. I do think that it's still an epidemic. We are not addressing it. I do believe that it's been ignored because this was not the addiction that people paid attention to, heroin addiction. It always happened in indigent communities, people of color, and it was not our problem. And now it is a predominant problem here, and people are looking at it as they should.
Well, let's drill down a little bit then. And Julian, to you, thoughts on how we can educate young people about the dangers here?
So we know that risk for opiate addiction starts as young as 12, 13, 14 years old. And, you know, talking about kind of some of the progress that's made, folks will often laud a curricula that's been put in schools and working groups that have been put in schools. But where are the resources for those schools to actually provide the prevention work? We know that when we provide well-funded prevention, that we're able to really make a difference. Look at the rate of change around tobacco use in young people. That just didn't happen because we were talking about these issues. That happened because millions and millions and millions of dollars were used primarily from tobacco settlements to fund that work. And so I'm just really not optimistic that we're really going to be able to move to where we need on prevention for young folks until we have adequately funded programs that are in our schools with health professionals. There's models of school-based health centers that I think are something that we have off Cape. I'd like to look at seeing those here on Cape. There's, you know, good work's happening, but I think we need to give our schools more resources.
And Sheila Lyons, the same question about educating young people about the dangers.
Well, part of what we're doing as far as our subcommittees is putting together a curriculum, and it is an education curriculum, much like the cessation of tobacco. So this is, I was listening on my way here that Falmouth High School has reported a drop in alcohol and marijuana use. I don't think that's just by accident. I think it's because there is attention, there is discussion about the dangers of these drugs, and that there is a program being in place from the efforts, and I'm proud to have led these efforts. This is something that we really worked on. It's one of the great accomplishments I feel that I've contributed to the county, and it does need more, and we do need more funding, but we have brought in over $1.5 million to this area to help with this cause, and I think it's beginning to show. It is an education. Addiction is more of a societal, it's an indication of where we are as a society. That's where we have to start looking as well.
You know, okay. And Sean, I would say, you know, I think curriculums are a start and nice to have, and there's a whole host of resources across the state, nationally. But really, if that's not backed up with funding, as a public health person, the hardest thing to fund is prevention. When I was at the Department of Public Health, helped contribute to budget advocacy for an agency with $600 million in funding with 56 line items. The line items that were hardest to fund were the prevention, the core services. I'd like to see us establish a substance abuse trust fund with a dedicated funding stream that's not subject to appropriations. Until we do that, again, we're just giving our schools a curriculum without the resources to implement.
Okay, let's move on. The MCAS test has been replaced by the PARC standardized test, which not all educators are happy about. Now we're working towards a hybrid of the two exams. Your thoughts on standardized testing in general and the impact these tests have on students in special education and vocational programs. Sheila, you're up first.
Well, I think that it's not bad to have measures as to where we are in teaching our students, but I think that over time we have relied so much on standardized testing that it's beginning to really reduce our creativity. It reduces the teacher's ability to be innovative in the classroom. We were able to put men on the moon in 1960, and I would venture to say that most of the people that were the scientists behind that effort probably went to public school. And they might have gone on to MIT or Harvard, but I would imagine many of them started in public schools. We don't have that same curriculum. It was much more creative. It was much more innovative. We're restricting education by focusing on task-oriented education and testing. I think that bringing in sciences, more hands-on. I like it when you read about students going out into gardens and onto the waterways. It's much more a holistic approach.
Julian's here.
So I'm someone who actually got to experience the beginning of standardized testing. When I was my class when I was graduating from Nauset High School was the first in the state that was required to pass the MCAS to graduate. There was one test. You took it your sophomore year. You had two or three other chances to pass it into your junior and senior year. Since then, we've gone so much further, so that testing starts in third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. My friends who are teachers, both here on the Cape and off Cape, are spending weeks and weeks of their time preparing for this test. It's gone too far, and the scorecards that are used for this are a real mismatch. So, for instance, we see for our Cape schools, the Nauset school is getting listed as a level two school because they didn't fit a certain scorecard from the state. That's just not the way to go about it. And all of this isn't backed up with funding. And so that's a real issue of equity. And it's a real challenge for us here on the Cape.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break here. My guests are Julian Sear and Sheila Lyons. They're running for the Cape and Islands Senate seat, presently held by Senator Dan Wolf. And if you have a question, you're welcome to give us a call, 866-999-4626, 866-999-4626. Or you can email thepoint@capeandislands.org and just remember to direct your question to both candidates, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to The Point on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran, and our primary debates are continuing this morning, and we're speaking with Julian Sear and Sheila Lyons. They're both running as Democratic candidates for the Cape and Islands State Senate seat being vacated by Dan Wolf. And so we're continuing with our questions. Julian, you get the next question here to start anyway. Do you support raising the cap on charter schools?
I don't support raising the cap on charter schools. I don't support question two. One, this isn't germane to education's concerns on the Cape and Islands. We are under the cap here on Cape Cod, on Martha's Vineyard, on Nantucket, excuse me. I'd really like us to see it to go back to the spirit of ed reform, the 1993 ed reform, where charter schools were meant to be have some synergy and really take best practices to improve districts. Currently on the Cape, we lose each of our school districts loses millions of dollars a year to charter schools. We have, I think we have examples of strong charters on the Cape. The Lighthouse Charter School in particular is the only charter school in the Commonwealth with a unionized workforce. But, you know, I'm really disappointed that this ballot initiative is going forward. I thought the Senate bill, a lot of people didn't seem happy with it. And I think that often is a sign of good legislation on both sides. But unfortunately, we're going to spend millions of dollars bringing this to the voters and not taking those dollars and putting them to our children.
Okay. Sheila Lyons, do you support raising the cap on charter schools?
No, I don't. I have concerns about charter schools, but right now the question is raising that cap. And we have not even hit the limit with that's under the cap. So I'm not sure why we want to raise it when we haven't built the schools or implemented the systems that are already in the queue, so to speak. The other thing is they do take tremendous amounts of money. My feeling about public education is that it is a fundamental tenet of our democracy. We have to have an educated population to be able to forward in and participate in the government that we have been given to have. And over time, civics has been taken out of education, all of these different curriculum that actually taught us how to be citizens, how to use our government, that we are the government. And this is, in many ways, dividing those who have and those who have not. And if you're lucky enough to get in that school, you get a good education. Whereas we should take that money, put it into all of the schools, lift every student up, and have every child get a quality education.
Okay, the town of Barnstable is suing the county of Barnstable because of groundwater contamination found at the county-run fire training area. We've seen these stories in the news. At first, it was thought to be a fairly well-contained area of contamination. We've learned recently that officials don't know how much pollution is in the groundwater, but they do know it's going to cost millions to clean up. Who should be responsible for that cleanup, and does the state have a role to play in this? And Sheila, you're first.
Yes, the state does have a role to play, but this is an indicator of many other abuses that have taken place over Cape Cod. We have a very pristine, fragile environment, or we had a pristine, until we thought that it was sort of a finite resource, and it's not. We're seeing it erode, and we have done years of damage to this, starting with our military base. We have a single-source aquifer. That has been a over $40 million cleanup, and it's still continuing. This is this piece of land that was part of the that is now part of the county was owned by Hyannis. It was acquired by the county about 20 years ago. So there was a lot of abuse that went on, use that of chemicals. It's not really abuse of what was thought to be okay to use. These are things that we assumed were going to be safe. Not only is it the fire departments that have trained there, but there is airports nearby, other industrial areas. This is everybody's problem. Everybody has to participate, both towns, the town and the county and the state.
And Julian Sear.
So I was director of policy and regulatory affairs for the Bureau of Environmental Health at the Department of Public Health for 3 years. And so we would work on issues around people's concerns around emerging health contaminants. So we're talking about several emerging contaminants that are found in the drinking water wells supplying Hyannis, including PFAS as an emerging contaminant. Anytime you're looking at environmental health issues, there's a lot of complications in it. And of course, there is a state's role. But what the county did here was really not respectful to the health concerns of residents in Hyannis. So we're engaged in a lawsuit now that the town is bringing against the county. And largely that stems from the county not being responsive to the town's concerns in recent years. It looks like there are maybe several different sources of contamination, including the fire training academy. As someone who's worked in environmental health, I think the most important thing you need to do when you have an emerging contaminant, regardless if you know all the answers or not, get people in a room. Say, here's what we know, here's what we don't know. If you are a parent or you have children or you're someone who's concerned about health in the drinking water supply in Hyannis, here are steps you can take to protect yourself. That did not happen.
I think I take issue with that. The county has been the most responsible entity in this whole thing. This was acquired, as I say, 20 years ago. Contaminations in this area over 20 years ago. The county has put in over millions of dollars. We have had this discussion publicly. We have had it with the towns publicly. We are the only ones who have responded and cleaned and monitored. We have monitored over the 20 years. And every time that there was something found, we have paid for it and we have cleaned it on our own. Now, and that's when we did not have the responsibility of how it got there. So to say that the county has been unresponsive, I take issue with that. I try to stand up and say that we should close all activity there.
Okay.
I am one of two commissioners. And Julie, I mean, of three commissioners, excuse me, if I don't have that vote.
Sorry, what was that, Sheila?
I said, excuse me, I was one of three commissioners. If everyone does not, if you can't have two people agree, it stays open. And there is a benefit to this area of that fire academy as well. That is too much to get into here.
Okay, so Julian, I'll give you a little extra time.
We've been knocking doors all across the Cape, including in Hyannis. And when I was just at a door last week in Hyannis, and the number one question from three people I talked to was about the water supply. So clearly, we haven't done a good job in responding to everyone's concerns about this issue. The town of Barnstable sent a communication to the county in May 2015 about this issue, and the county didn't even get back to the town until 2016. So I'm not saying the county's, you know, the only entity here at fault. I think clearly there are a number of factors and a number of sources of contamination. But I think that from when I'm talking to people, there's a number of concerns here. And I think that we've got more work to do to make sure people can have their concerns about PFAS aired.
And if I can just say one other thing, this Mary Dunn well is not the only issue that Barnstable has or towns across the Cape, including Truro and Wellfleet. We have our very severe problems because those towns have also been unresponsive.
Julian, any final thoughts?
I mean, again, I'm saying the work here is when there is an environmental contaminant, the work is about bringing folks together and saying, all right, here's what we know. Here's what we don't know. Clearly, I think there's multiple sources of contamination at this site. But again, it's not about, oh, it's not my problem. It's your problem. It's about getting everyone together to work on the issue and to address health concerns. And it's about making sure that our residents and people who are concerned about this can take steps to protect themselves.
Okay. I think that a lot of those steps have been taken. There are a lot of issues going on. A lot of it is within executive session. I cannot get into it here, but many of the things that have been stated here have been done. If people are unaware of it, maybe they weren't listening at the time that it was being discussed.
Okay. Can we move on?
Absolutely.
Okay. Excellent. Back and forth. Thank you. Let's talk about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, which is set to close in 2019. And there are concerns about safety. And do you have concerns about safety at the plant? And Sheila, you went first last time. I think, Julian, it's your turn this time.
Absolutely. I have concerns about this plant. I've been to this facility. This is a corroding facility. When you're at the plant, it's just clear. If you look at the record of safety concerns we've had, this plant needs to close. But beyond closing it, and we know it's closing, we need to get it to close sooner. I'm really focused on the decommissioning effort. So what Entergy and the utility and the NRC is going to want to do, would prefer to do, is to put the utility into something which is called Safe Store, which essentially allows you to mothball the plant for up to 60 years. This is a horrible option that could potentially allow leaving the spent fuel that's stored six stories up to be left there and not moved into dry cask storage. We need to do everything in our power, and our toolkit is a little limited here, so this is frustrating, to make sure that this utility moves that spent fuel out of that volatile fuel pool into dry cask storage. I've worked on these issues at the state. I helped draft an amendment Sarah Peake filed around establishing a special commission around decommissioning and really understand how you push the utility to get them to be accountable on this. But we've got a long way to go, and I think the focus increasingly needs to be on a swift decommissioning.
And Sheila Lyons.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think that there are several concerns here. The state, federal government, Entergy all knew that this was coming to its end. They knew that there was a timeline to this being not licensed. Efforts were made by the Patrick administration to increase renewable energies. A lot of those were fought, whether it be wind, solar. Everybody has an issue with one of these renewable energies, and a lot of it is disinformation that's put out into the public. The fact is we are in a severe we are having the severe consequences of climate change happening because we have not been able to address our future energy distribution. So we leave this aging plant in place. We do not think about how are we going to replace the energy that it does create for us. So once this is closed, we are going to be increasing our greenhouse gases. people are going to be displaced from work. They have to be retrained, and the decommissioning cannot fall on the backs of the people of Cape Cod or Massachusetts. This is a private company. They should be held accountable, and it has to be having an advisory committee that includes citizens from Cape Cod.
Well, let's stick with that question that you just rose there, Sheila Lyons, and it's going to go to you first. Continuing with that Pilgrim issue, the legislature recently passed a measure creating a Pilgrim decommissioning panel, and the measure was spearheaded by three of our region's representatives to the State House, yet there are no Cape seats on this panel. Does that matter to you, and would you work to change that?
Yes, I would work to change that, and it does matter to me because ultimately this is damaging this is Cape Cod Bay that is being affected. The winds blow over Cape Cod, so whatever is leaking, whatever gases are leaking from this are coming our way. This is the direction it comes in. We're probably getting more of the negative impact of that plant than any other place on the state because of wind direction. So, and then it spins out again in the afternoon and comes back at us one more time. So this is, we have every right to have a seat at that table. We have every right to make sure that the money is not put on the citizens of this area. And just as we did at the base, and that advisory committee is still in place. I sit on that committee as a commissioner, and it is a very robust and ongoing effort. So this is something that I firmly believe we should have a seat at the table, and I would fight to have that seat.
And Julian's here.
So in the language that I helped draft with Sarah Peake, we did have seats for representatives from the Cape and Islands. I'm really disappointed that's not in the final bill. I'm also really disappointed that the Attorney General doesn't have the seat at the table. As someone who's worked in a state agency, one of the state agencies that's responsible for the environmental monitoring program at the plant, that's responsible for co-investigation of a tritium leak at this plant. It's really important to me, having been in it, that we have another component in government to hold MEMA accountable, to hold the Department of Public Health accountable, to hold other environment, the Department of Energy Resources and others. I'm really disappointed the Attorney General isn't there. And I think overall with this, we've done a really poor job of risk communication and talking about the risks that associate with Pilgrim. And the risks are very significant, but the state And the regions we've not done a good job. We've really not done a good job explaining risk, and so that I think people do imagine that there's going to be sort of an atom bomb over Plymouth, or that gases are leaking kind of everywhere, and it's really put our region at greater harm. And so I think what we need to do is have Cape Codders, Islanders, have a seat at the table, making sure that we exactly know what this means for our community in every scenario, and that hasn't happened.
Okay, we're speaking with Julian Sear and Sheila Lyons. They're running for the Cape and Islands Senate seat, presently held by Senator Dan Wolf. And we welcome your questions as well, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can email thepoint@capeandislands.org and just make sure your question is directed at both candidates if you do that. Two senators have proposed legislation that would put a price on carbon throughout the economy, not just the energy sector. Any business bringing fossil fuels into the state would pay a fee, and the revenue would be refunded to Massachusetts residents. Julian Sear, we'll start with you. Would you support such legislation?
Yes.
And tell
I support
us why.
This legislation. You know, and nowhere more acutely than here on Cape Cod, on Martha's Vineyard, and on Nantucket, where we are already seeing the effects of climate change, where even if we stopped putting out all the carbon that's going out today, we still are going to have to prepare our communities for rising sea levels, for the damage that's been done. A price on carbon, most economists agree this makes sense and is really the only way to kind of reduce this. I think the additional piece is that we need to keep Massachusetts being on the forefront of clean energy. A part of that is about what's happening here in Woods Hole, what's happening in the blue economy. Part of that is going to be the very exciting projects that are happening south, 15 miles south of Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket. We've got a great company that's based on Martha's Vineyard who has won the bid for one of those projects. So I'm really interested in how the Commonwealth can reclaim our position and how Cape Cod and the islands can reclaim our and keep our position as really leading in this. And a carbon tax is part of it. I know there's costs associated with it, but we've got to do this. Otherwise, we might be underwater. Well, we will be underwater.
Sheila Lyons.
I do support the carbon tax, and I do support any effort that we can that will accelerate and hasten our reduction and transition to renewable energies. Not only is it that we have to place carbon tax that has been proposed that will give revenue to Massachusetts to create those renewable energies and to monitor them, but we have to look at how our energy is distributed. The DPU has now, for the first time in its history, mandated that the energy distributors across Massachusetts modernize their grid, that they modernize their system. We have two distributors that affect us, National Grid, and we here on Cape Cod is Eversource. Eversource is not, I believe their proposal is not meeting the mark. We could do better, but there is a more of a visionary way we can look at our energy distribution. The money from the cap should be able to go into that and look for future generations here.
Let's move on to the economy, and there has been a push for what is being called the blue economy and supporting marine-centered industries here. What is your plan for economic growth in the region? And Sheila, you're up first.
So Cape Cod and the islands have been somewhat isolated because of their coastal geography. So therefore, they've always had to rely on their own industry. Historically, Cape Cod was self-reliant. It had fishing industry, agricultural history. It was a place where writers and artists came. It was a self-generating economy. That has changed because of tourism. Now we have tourism as our dominant economy, and it is something that we have to maintain. It's our booming economy. We have to protect our environment. We have to also look within ourselves. We have many things in place right now to protect that environment. We have wastewater plans going forward. We have energy and renewables coming forward. We have got to look at our curriculum, start to build our STEM courses to reflect the environment around us, marine life, agriculture, renewable energies. These are our new economies that are homegrown and can stay within the economy. But our fishing industry and shellfish industry, we have to support.
And Julian Sear, your plan for economic growth for the region.
So, you know, this isn't the first time that the Cape and Islands have been in a moment of economic change. I think of the end of salt making, the end of the whaling industry, the advent of tourism. What's changed now is that tourism and hospitality continues to be our bread and butter. But the ability, because our cost of living here, especially affordability of housing, has gone up, that it doesn't, you know, working three jobs in the summer doesn't cut it anymore. I think first on hospitality, we have to focus on hospitality. Lengthening our season makes a critical difference. In my family, there was always a conversation about how, do we stay open through September? Does the restaurant stay open till October? Funding for regional tourism councils makes a huge difference. Governor Baker actually vetoed this and the legislature had to override it, but that funding for tourism in the state has been level funding or almost decreased. For every dollar we invest in tourism in the state, we get five back. Second, working on our healthcare workforce to make sure that we have needs for our aging population. And then third on innovation, I think our job as state senators is really to push for a building out of our infrastructure. We have the Open Cape Network, but we got to go the last mile there. New building at Cape Cod Community College, support for aquaculture, and so forth.
Okay. Sheila, 30 seconds.
So tourism is our major economy, and we have to, but to keep that major economy, we have to protect our environment. The increase of people that we have here during our tourism season is 500 to 750,000 people. That takes effect here. We have to look at what are we doing for the year-round economy and how are we going to have jobs that pay a living wage and enable people to live here. So that is why we have to look at the solutions and how we're building a sustainable and resilient economy that to support, in a sense, the tourism.
And Sheila's absolutely right here. The environment is our economy in Cape Cod, and I think, you know, we've done some work on this. We've got more work to do, but the environment is really key to all of our futures here.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We have lots more questions to get to with the two Democratic candidates for state Senate seat for the Cape and the Islands, and we'll be back. Welcome back to The Point on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me are the two candidates running for the Cape and Islands state Senate seat being vacated by Dan Wolf, and those candidates are Julian Sear and Sheila Lyons, and we've been discussing a whole slew of issues here on the Cape and the Islands. Now let's move on to affordable housing, one of those perennial issues that we've talked about for decades. It's particularly bad on Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, of course. How would you propose to create more affordable housing, not only for low-income people, but also those young families who are finding it difficult to live and remain in this place? And Julian, you're up first.
So not only on Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, but especially on the Outer Cape, mm-hmm. And Sheila, in my neck of the woods, where our housing is just profoundly unaffordable. We need more housing affordability, and I say housing affordability specifically. The current affordable housing programs help a certain segment of the population, but for many of us, we either make too much money to qualify or not enough to get a loan from the bank. I'd like to see a prioritization on affordable rental units. Rentals are not only helpful from a workforce perspective, from a young professional perspective, but also for folks like my parents who may own a large aging Cape home who want to downsize. I've had friends, a couple in Wellfleet who actually were looking to downsize here, couldn't find anything that was affordable, left the Cape. And so I think affordable rentals are part of it. Then what we need is for once folks are into an affordable rental or they're, living in an accessory dwelling unit with their family, they need to have a mechanism to save to actually buy here. I'm proposing a tax-free savings account for first-time homeowners. This is something that's been proposed and implemented in other states, and it's effective.
Sheila Lyons.
So we have to really, first of all, having second home ownership on Cape Cod, when that boom started to happen, it was looked at as a good thing. It was a easy tax income for towns. We didn't have to build the infrastructure. Those people left they were only here for 3 months. Not a bad thing, but they overbuilt, and now we have no room to build, and we have very little land, and the land that we have left, a lot of it is sensitive. It's environmentally sensitive. It's near waterways. It's near flood zones. So we have to, this is all about a planning issue, and it's about how are we going to revitalize our communities, the village centers. So the more we can build affordable housing closer together to our natural village centers, the more we can look at the types of housing for different age. You're single, you need a certain type of housing, rental housing, apartment. Maybe that way when you're first married as a married couple, you have children, you expand, you retire, you decrease again. We have to have variation. We have to have multi-family housing, mm-hmm. and we have to think every house is one house on its own lot. We have to have multiple houses within an acreage or a half an acre.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to chime in and say, Sean, you said this is something we've been dealing with for decades, and that's right. I feel like we've been talking about this since I was in middle school, and that's a long time ago. In Truro, for instance, from 2000 to 2010, we built 500 units in the town. Guess how many were for year-round families? 34. And there's just a total mismatch. I mean, I haven't met a person in Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard, anywhere that doesn't get that we're profoundly unaffordable. But for some reason, we haven't been able to move forward on this. And, if we don't do something now, I don't know how many more folks like me are going to be around.
In June, the legislature's Joint Committee on Revenue recommended that the legislature expand the state's room occupancy excise tax to include vacation home rentals. The idea is that it could generate hundreds of thousands of dollars to local towns. What are your thoughts on taxing vacation home rentals? And Sheila, you're up first.
So this has a lot of people concerned. So again, we have a majority of rental housing, our second home ownership. Many of those are rented for supplement income. And for those people who move out of their house, and it happens here, it happens on the island, I understand that that supplements your income. And there is a fear that if you put this tax on there, those people will not rent my home. I've heard that over and over again. Well, maybe your regular tenant may not, but there will be someone that comes in behind you. I have gone back and forth on this, but the fact is the The payment of that tax is by the renter. So the person who comes in to rent your house pays the fee. You have to file the fee, which is a little extra work, but it's just a little bit extra work that is along with your own taxes. We have, as I say, anywhere between 500 and 750,000 people here on a given day on Cape Cod. That's that many people flushing toilets, generating trash, trampling our dunes, using our waterways, putting, you know, discharging boats. It has an impact, and we need to, how are we going to fix this? Are we going to pay for it? Nobody wants to pay for it here. That's why it continues to happen. So this is a mechanism of a user fee is the way I would look at it.
Julian's here.
I support expansion of the room occupancy tax, and here's why. You know, you're often going to get politicians telling you, well, I'm going to go up to Beacon Hill and fight for more local aid, more Chapter 70 aid. But from Boston's gaze, they look at us, they see the relatively lower property tax rates that many of our towns have. They don't understand that for most of us, either you're living on a fixed income and you own your home here, or like my family, you're land rich and cash poor. And so we need, and Beacon Hill needs to give our communities alternative ways to generate revenue. Expansion of the room occupancy tax just makes sense. I don't buy this argument. You know, you have to go, if you don't want to pay this tax, you have to go to Delaware to avoid it. Every other state in the Northeast does this. And I think it just makes common sense. What I am concerned about, I think we need a mechanism to make collection easier. I think that, you know, that's why you see folks who do Airbnb. My parents do Airbnb broadly in support of this because Airbnb already has a built-in mechanism. It's a little more difficult with, you know, we need a vacation.com or other sites. But if we can figure out that mechanism, make it a little easier, this just makes plain sense. And I'm disappointed, very disappointed, the legislature wasn't able to get this through this session.
30 seconds, Sheila?
Yeah, I just want to add to that that, you know, the more you have these Airbnbs, the more more and more homes or inns, you know, guest houses have been bought, especially on the Outer Cape, and made single homes. That is another decrease on our revenue. I mean, people do not understand that taxes are something we pay to reinvest in ourselves. This is how we fix things. This is how we pay for our schools. This is how we pay for our fire, our police, our roads. And if we don't have some money somewhere, it's not going to happen. That's why we are eroding, our middle class is eroding along as our dunes are.
Absolutely. Well said, Sheila. Absolutely.
Julian, next question to you. What is your opinion on about efforts by the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah to open a bingo slots parlor in a building it owns on Martha's Vineyard in Aquinnah? Should the state be assisting in that effort, or should it continue to fight the proposal in the courts?
Mm. Good question. You know, I think I can look at this from the gaze as someone of living in a town that is a little bit bigger than Aquinnah, but not much, in Truro. This is something that I wouldn't want in my community. Of course, we are talking about sovereign land. I think there's a lot of logistical questions that are raised about having a facility here. If you've been out to Aquinnah, I've been out there several times in this campaign before. It's far out there. The infrastructure is not in place to support that sort of facility. So although this is sovereign land, to get people there has to go through, you know, roads and all this infrastructure, the Steamship Authority, all these things that we invest in and we pay for. So I think this is a real mismatch for the community. It is around a sovereign issue. But like many islanders and people who are members of the tribe, I don't support this.
You know, we have a legislature that just cannot seem to, and Democrats along with there's more Democrats, so let's say the Democrats, they don't want a tax. Everyone has bought into the notion that taxes are bad. And I do think that we have to really start to think about what are taxes and what are they for. I am not saying to put undue burden on those who have been paying their way. There are a lot of people up on the top who have loopholes, who make huge income, and do not pay their fair share of taxes. And I think that has to change. Number two, again, we're supporting Indian tribes that have been given the short end, let's say, since the white man came here. And how are we supporting them? We're allowing them to have casinos. Again, it's a cowardly way of generating revenue without facing the fact of we have to have revenue and we all got to pay for this. So to bring casinos into the mix in general, I don't agree with. And to give that as the only mechanism for our Indian tribes, I think, is another further insult.
Just, you know, Sean, I've always had concerns about gaming. Worked on concerns when this was going through the legislature when I was at the Department of Public Health. I really think that the revenue we've projected from these two or three facilities in the Commonwealth, four facilities, is not going to meet what we projected originally in the budget. We're seeing that with Plainfield. I really fear that, you know, in 15 or 20 years, folks like us will be working on this issue to dismantle this. It's been a real and why it's happened is because there isn't courage around having an honest conversation about revenue and fees in the legislature. It's a politically convenient one to tell folks every year, no new taxes, no new fees. That's why I support the Fair Share Amendment, taxing people with incomes over $1 million. We've got to have this conversation. Otherwise, we're just shooting ourselves in the foot.
Shoa, can we move on to the next question? Do you support expanding the bottle bill to include rebates on things like nips, those little alcohol bottles we see by the side of the road so often, and non-carbonated beverages like sports drinks and water?
You know, I think that as far as, you know, to many in many ways, it is a way of making sure that they do not go into our, you know, our waste stream and people recycle. I know that I haven't really recycled at my dump, but I don't turn in, you know, I don't have a revenue from it. I don't turn it into get cash back, which we probably should. I think anything to make people think twice about just throwing something away is not a bad thing. I know that there are little nips, but, you know, if you've gone by certain areas, you've seen a lot of those. There's a lot of waste there.
And go ahead, Julian.
Yes, I support expansion of the bottle bill in many iterations of this bill, which I worked on in prior sessions, actually ties some of the revenue generated for an expanded bottle bill towards prevention for public health services, again, for the services that we often underfund. And, you know, I get there's a concern from some small business owners about the expansion of the bottle bill. I've spoken with friends of mine who own markets and businesses and who sell nips, my friends Ellery and Claire, who own Salty Market in North Truro. And they just think this just makes sense. Plus, from an environmental perspective, we know how effective the bottle bill has been in containing refuse and trash. And as someone who lives quite near a store where there's a lot of nips, you see that.
Well, time's gotten away with us with this vigorous debate here. So, Ashila, if you could begin maybe a minute for a closing statement.
Yes, thank you. You know, 6 years ago, I was sitting here with Dan Wolf for this same seat. And happily, Dan was elected. And at that time, people said to me, you need more experience. And they were right. It does give you a better education when you are working on the local level. So for the last 8 years as county commissioner, I have worked with 15 towns, 15 local boards, 15 towns of nonprofits and human services to the environment. It has made a difference, and I do believe that for a Senate seat, you are best to have the education on the local. You cut your political teeth at the local level. I am in this because I'm a social worker. I have loved Cape Cod. I care about Cape Cod, and I now want to bring the experience that you have all given me to the Senate. I am ready to start day one, and there is a sense of urgency I feel around a lot of these issues. I know where we're going. Mm-hmm. I know the work that's been done. I know what we need to do.
Julian's here.
My background has prepared me really well for this job. I've taken on tough issues and had a record of accomplishment, starting off when I was a junior at Nauset High School, leading an effort to save 40 teaching positions from budget cuts to Nauset schools. That was successful. And I've had that record of accomplishment since, working at the national level, coming home to Massachusetts, applying at the state level, working on issues that are tough around Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, making sure that we keep our oyster harvesters in business during summer months, during a difficult pathogen. Having grown up in and of a small business, I get the challenges and the real joys as well of running of businesses that are really the vitality of our local economy. I'm someone who's been committed to work in social justice for LGBTQ rights, for women's rights since day one. And I think we really need a progressive voice to carry on the work of Senator Wolf. And I really want to work to ensure that families like mine have a future on Cape Cod. And when I say families like mine, I just don't mean people like me or my sister and her wife who just moved back home to Truro. I mean my parents who are in their 60s and who are, needing to have a financially secure retirement. So that's why I'm in this. I'm just really grateful for the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
And thank to both of you, Julian Sear and Sheila Lyons. They're running for the Cape and Islands Senate seat being held by, presently, Senator Dan Wolf. The primary, Thursday, September 8th. Thanks for listening.